KCSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today. Today I'm excited to have on the founder and president of a new nonprofit called Securing Change. Securing Change is an organization that has recently been formed, and its focus is to offer nonprofit organizations pro bono or free security, website security services to deal with the scourge of hackers and so forth. As the website for securingchange.org says, it helps protect the integrity of organizations' information systems by providing security solutions, standards, testing methods, and checklists covering basic procedures for safe computing. We have focused on Hearsay Culture numerous times over the last six-plus years of the show on issues involving hacking and cybersecurity, from guests ranging from Derek Bambauer, who was on the board of Securing Change, to professors like Paul Ohm, to others discussing the tragedy involving the apparent suicide of Aaron Swartz under, at least to some degree, the pressure of pending criminal charges involving the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which is a federal criminal law that is designed to criminalize the kinds of behaviors that Securing Change is designed to confront. And over the years, we've also talked more broadly about issues of cyber espionage, issues that I focus on through my personal trade secrecy work, but also work that and issues that we've discussed in a variety of other settings involving everything from copyright infringement to getting around digital rights management software. So when you attempt to copy an MP3, you deal with that issue. And today we're going to drill down specifically on what the current threats are as far as cybersecurity and websites are, and we're going to talk in the second half of the show about Securing Change. The timeliness of this interview, which is being recorded on May 14th for airing on May 15th on KZSU, is pretty stark. Ron Deibert of Citizen Lab in Canada and a former guest on this show several years ago wrote an interesting blog post on Circle ID a couple of months ago entitled "Civil Society Hung Out to Dry in Global Cyber Espionage." And the post focuses on issues involving the increasing focus and heavy focus right now on Chinese cyber espionage and what to do about it. And there, the focus has been exclusively on what the impact is on corporations, on private entities that hold trade secrets and other valuable information, and what happens to that information when it is misappropriated or stolen through often and usually through hacks and other activities that, again, Securing Change would address. And in the piece that that Ron wrote, and quoting him, he said, "While cyber espionage against a company may result in a loss of a blueprint, an attack on a non-governmental entity," so think about a non-profit, "could result in a loss of individual life or liberty. Yet civil society is largely on its own as it goes about its work to advance human rights and other public policy goals while struggling to stay ahead of debilitating cyber threats." With that setup, enter Securing Change. And so I'm excited to have Oliver on today. By way of a brief background, Oliver is an information security professional. He's consulted many Fortune 100 companies over the last 10 years. He's developed security audits and other services dealing with cybersecurity. He has done information security work at companies like iDigital, Symantec, StopBadware, and Akamai. He has a pretty diverse background, although we're not going to be focusing on it here because he says that he's also deeply fascinated by urban farming and has a thriving herb garden. He's an avid student of Mandarin. This interview will, however, be in English, international relations in Asia. And so I'm very excited to have Oliver today. By way of caveat and disclosure, I am also personally on the board of Securing Change. That is something I wanted to say up front, although I will maintain as much as one can my journalistic integrity and not attempt to ask loaded questions, but I did want to make that disclosure up front. So joining us from Securing Change's offices via Skype in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Oliver, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks, Dave. It's great to be back on the show again.
And yes, I neglected to say that you were on the show, God, at this point, at least, I'd say probably 2 or 3 years ago, involving your article with Derek Bambauer entitled The Hacker's Aegis. So I'm very happy to have you back on the show and to talk about this exciting new project. I'm sure I asked you this question 3 years ago, but let's update it here. And perhaps I'll ask the question a little more specifically. So we're going to talk in the interview in the first half broadly about what these threats are before getting into the specifics of what Securing Change is designed to do. But let me ask you this question up front. Why Securing Change? Why did you think it was necessary to form this organization?
The idea for Securing Change came about actually, I think, somewhat like 7 years ago now. I was living in Cambridge, and I was talking with one of my neighbors, and she was in business school, but before she got in, she used to work at Planned Parenthood. And I know that this can be a bit of a divisive organization, but her nightmare, the thing that she imparted to me, was that when she worked there, there was a group of hackers that were intent on getting into the database that contained the names of all the women who had services there and exposing that onto the internet. And I think there was actually a case very similar to that that actually happened in the UK. And when I heard that story, it just killed me. I could not believe that they were having to deal with that kind of threat. And she said they had no budget. They barely have enough money for their IT services, and they couldn't afford. At the time, I was working for a company called AtStake. They couldn't afford consultants that typically charge, you know, $200 an hour. And you know, I was younger then, and in my first, unfortunately, the first thought in my head was, you know, let's go find these guys and expose them and maybe take down their organization. But it made me realize, I realized quickly that wasn't the answer, that the answer was to find a way to help organizations like Planned Parenthood to get them the defenses that they needed without having, you know, to make them pay the hundreds of dollars per hour that, you know, corporations like, you know, Best Buy or Wells Fargo can afford. So the idea sort of had to sit for a while because I wasn't at a point in my life where I could really make that that idea come into reality. But about 6 months ago, maybe about 5 months ago, I found myself in a place where it made sense to try and really do something with the idea. So I studied you know, how to form a nonprofit corporation, went through all the legal steps to start that process, started recruiting volunteers, started building the infrastructure, and we got our first client within a few months. That's still something we're struggling with, but yeah, that's where the idea came from, was just watching someone who lived below the security poverty line getting bullied, and just being really offended by that and wanting to do something to help.
Now, I want to get into the details of Securing Change later in the interview, but I think to set up that discussion, and particularly for those of you that aren't familiar, right? I mean, frankly, the questions you have on the website at securingchange.org are pretty good, and so therefore I'm going to crib directly from it and ask this overview question. When we talk about information security, what is it and why is it important?
I mean, digital security is your ability to use your computer and not have other people exploit those computers and essentially take your crown jewels. Like every organization has its own crown jewels, right? Like, you know, for companies like these defense contractors, it's going to be classified secrets. But for a lot of nonprofits, their crown jewels are their donor database. For, you know, these NGOs, their crown jewels are going to be the communications of their activists. And as we heard about recently, you know, the crown jewel of some of these media corporations are the emails between journalists and their sources, which there was recently an article about how I think the FBI just was able to get phone taps on these journalists without their knowledge. And I think they're very, very quickly learning that they need to scrutinize their contract with their telcos and maybe figure out some different operational security. But it's, you know, the ability to secure those things, to make safe those things which you value the most. You know, we can't be all things to all people. We have a few services that we're rolling out in the beginning. I'm focusing a lot on web server security. I feel like every organization.
Well, you know what, Oliver, I'm going to interrupt you before we even get into securing change. I think because a lot of what you're about to refer to will make more sense to listeners with a few more setup questions. So, if you'll indulge these, because I know you are eager to talk about securing change, and I'm excited to have you on the show. Taking a step back, as I mentioned in the introduction, right? The issue of cybersecurity is currently in the news. You've mentioned this story, which literally was announced, I think, yesterday, with regard to these wiretaps. But what has gotten a lot of attention recently, as I mentioned in the introduction, is Chinese cyber espionage. So perhaps you could frame the problem. You know, aside from the general point, perhaps specifics in terms of the scope of the problem, how prevalent this behavior is, and then my follow question, which we can get to, is how are these things done typically? But let's start with the scope of the problem. You know, we hear a lot about it, but what's your take on how prevalent these kinds of attacks and hacks are today?
Right. So there's an analyst, Wendy Nather, from 451 Research, and she has this term called the security poverty line. So really what information security boils down to is a set of practices and or products that you use to keep your organization safe, right? Making safe those things which you value. And the term security poverty line refers to a certain amount of money that an organization is going to need to spend in order to keep themselves safe. So they're going to need to buy a certain amount of intrusion prevention devices, you know, things that will let you know that the attacker is coming. For those that still believe in antivirus, you know, antivirus, firewalls. So she has this number that she's done in her research, or that she's figured out in her research. And if your budget, and not your IT budget, if your security budget falls below this number, she says that you're under the poverty line, right? And so that means you don't have enough money to go out and buy, like, the basic building blocks to keep intruders out of your computer systems, or to even know that they're attacking you or they've gotten in. And so part of the problem is that we don't know how prevalent it is. Most of us assume that it's incredibly prevalent because a lot of the people that I've talked to and a lot of the stories that I've read, these groups that are under the poverty line, they've given up, right? They don't even try to just spend what they can. They just say, you know what, our strategy is we'll deal with it once it happens. Once we're attacked, we'll just deal with it then. And not realizing that it's cheaper to buy things or set up things that will prevent these issues, versus having to pay out the nose once you've already been attacked. Incident response, it literally triples the rates, of the people that will come in to help you. And so that if you are an attacker, you can, you know, look at the landscape of those that you want to attack. And you know, your Fortune 500 companies, they're going to have a decent budget. So they're going to see the attacks coming, hopefully. Sometimes they don't, as we've read about in the news. But they've at least, you know, done some of the due diligence to get the equipment out there, and to hire the staff necessary to run and analyze the logs that come out of these machines and these, software programs. But, you know, nonprofits, NGOs, they barely have enough money to keep, you know, an $8 a month website going. They borrow and beg, IT resources from friends and friends of friends. So when they are attacked, it's like walking into, you know, like a burglar finding a house with the door unlocked, if there's even a door at all. And they can just walk in, you know, there's no cameras, there's no one even home most of the time. And they can take whatever they want without being detected. And the two, I think, most common forms of attack that you're going to see now are website attacks. When I was at Stop Badware, we called them the drive-by download. This is the term coined by Neil Provost from Google. And this is where instead of just defacing the website and saying, ha, 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 we got into your website, they take the HTML for the page and they inject a or they add an iframe or some JavaScript, and that will pull an exploit in from another server that they control. So anyone who looks at the website will now, if they're running a vulnerable browser, and it's a pretty big list, will suddenly find that the attacker can take control of their computer.
Now, I want to translate that for a sec, but tell me if tell me if I'm correct. In layperson's terms, what you're saying is that someone will insert some kind of code or software into a website, and by virtue of putting that code or software into the website, we'll be able to then take it over, control it, enter and exit databases at will, and so forth.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Exactly. But not only that, but anyone who looks at the website through their browser, there's lots of browser exploits, right? Like these are programs that will allow the attacker to take control of the computer that's running the browser, right? So the browser is the vector into the computer. And so you put this exploit on the website itself, and that people that look at it, if they're not running the most up-to-date browser, and honestly, there's even things out there called 0 days, which means even if they're running the most current version of their browser with all the patches installed, they're still going to get, in our parlance, we call it their own, right? So their computer is now under the control of the attacker, which means, you know, they can listen in on the mic, they can take pictures with the webcam, they can record all the keystrokes, anything that's written to the disk, they can get a copy of that. And when I was studying epidemiological models and biostatistics, I was fascinated with this concept where, you know, they became the source of the infection. And the full life cycle is that, the webmaster himself would get infected by looking at his own website. And now the attacker controls that person's laptop, and they rummage basically and look for FTP passwords to any other websites they control. And now they can inject into all of those websites. And then all the people who look at those websites, you know, there's a chance that one of them will get infected. And if that person who just got infected controls another website, it just propagates further and further and further.
So we're chatting with Oliver Day from Securing Change on KZSF. I'm Stanford and Hearsay Culture. To interrupt you here, Oliver, I want to make sure we're clear about this. As you talk about these methods, these are methods that to be clear would be effective against everyone from your home computer to a server or, you know, large computer at a sophisticated corporation. Am I right about that?
Absolutely. This affects everyone from government organizations to the Fortune 100 and the mom and pop shops that you see, which the security industry tried to do reputation services for a while. So, you know, like the sort of sleazy gambling website that used to infect you, that was a good counter to that. But now that they're infecting nonprofit organizations, like the New York Times was infected at one point because the attacker figured out how to infect the ad network. So one of the ads that was showing on the New York Times website was in fact infecting people that were looking at it. Now they found it, they figured it out pretty quickly, which is the major difference between websites with lots of money and websites that are run by mom and pop, mm-hmm. is the length of the infection. So the New York Times, they figured it out, I think, within a day, and they isolated the cause. They yelled at people, probably at the ad website, and they got it, you know, they effectively, you know, reversed it. But the mom and pop shops, these infections can last for weeks, if not months. And it makes reputation systems unworkable, because these are normally very, you know, unmalicious websites. They're just, you know, trying to sell things or tell you about their life or whatever. But, you know, they get infected and suddenly, you know, they're infectious. And if you look at them with the wrong browser, now your computer's infected, and so on. So that's the biggest threat that I think is out there, and one that I'm very personally invested in researching and helping people with. The other big threat that I see out there and that is very effective is phishing. And phishing is sending someone a an email that will contain a link or the infection within it, like, you know, click on this thing. But again, since so many people look at their mail through a browser, these same sort of browser-based exploits are effective against phishing. But it's on it, like, you don't even really need to have it embedded. You can just say, hey, click on this link. And then there's another form of phishing called spear phishing. And I know these terms are just crazy, but they all make sense when you think about them. So phishing, it's the idea that you're, like, you know, casting a line, and once you hook someone, you reel them in. Spear phishing is a very targeted, a very, very targeted attack against someone. So, when I've done contract penetration tests, we'll do spear phishing by looking at an organization's posts on, you know, these tech websites and on Usenet. And if we figure out, oh, well, some of their admins have had questions about Novell, right? We'll craft an email, make it look like we're actually coming from the Novell Corporation, and write to, you know, send emails to these admins and say, hey, we're from Novell. We've heard you had some questions about whatever. We want to, you know, help you with that. Click on this link to, you know, get more information. And then at that point, if they fall for it and they click on it, we can then control their computer. Mm-hmm. So if you think about, like, admins are going to be hopefully a little bit more wary. They're not always. But, you know, people that are answering emails for an NGO, they lack the training or the awareness that people are actively doing this. And to be honest, some of these phishing attacks are going to be so well crafted, right? Because forging an email is literally the easiest thing in the world. I mean, maybe not literally the easiest thing in the world to do, but it is impossible to have an email be absolutely authentic. Like, I could write an email to you and make it came from you. Mm-hmm. And really, the only way you can tell is if you really dig down into the headers. You might be able to figure out that there are IP addresses in the path that shouldn't be there. But this is all incredibly technical. And most people, when they look at their email, they're not looking at the headers. It's a completely hidden world because UI designers want email to be accessible. So forging emails, incredibly easy. Spear phishing, an incredibly effective attack. So everyone is susceptible to this type of attack. Large organizations that are incredibly security aware, like Akamai, to the smallest NGO, and really, like, the NGOs are the ones who are going to be affected the most, because if they fall for spear phishing, right, there's the chance that the attacker can now read through all their emails, see what they're up to. I mean, this is the stuff that's documented by Citizen Lab when they talk about GhostNet. You know, they were able, the people, and we're pretty sure we know who it was, but the group that was responsible for hacking into the Dalai Lama's, email infrastructure.
You said the Dalai Lama?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The people that hacked into the Dalai Lama's emails were aware of the meetings that they were having, in the future, and were able to email the Dalai Lama and say, look, we don't think you should have that meeting. And it was, you know, a very private email between you know, them and the people they're going to meet with. NGOs are at a huge disadvantage when it comes to spear phishing, because they need to be open to talking with other people, but it's so easy for the attacker to impersonate the people that they want to talk to and say, here, just click on this link. And if they're not trained properly, they'll just do it. And suddenly their computer is under the control of the attacker. And again, the crown jewels here are the conversations that they're having. What, you know, who are their activists? What are they doing? And as you pointed out in that article, you know, instead of just losing a blueprint and maybe, you know, missing out on their quarterly earnings, like, people could actually lose their lives. They could go to jail. they might not be able to travel to another country ever again. These are pretty harsh consequences just for clicking on the wrong thing.
We're chatting with Oliver Day of Securing Change on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it is on KZSU, which is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu or go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope you continue listening. So, Oliver, to personalize this and also to transition into more specific discussion of securing change, and I blogged a little bit about this when it was happening, but I never got into many details, but I think it's relevant here. As you know, for reasons that I'm going to mention in a moment, Hearsay Culture, the website, .com, has been the subject of cyber attacks with some frequency over the last 2 or 3 years. I mentioned you on the air then, I will mention it now though, part of the reason why I am on the board of Securing Change and why I think it's so valuable is that as the old commercial for the hair treatment for men used to say, I'm not only someone involved, but I'm a client. And so I went to Oliver before this organization existed and basically asked him if he could help out in any way, because what was going on was beyond my rudimentary expertise. He generously volunteered and ridded the website through some creative solutions, which we don't need to discuss on the air, but which I would imagine you might offer to other potential clients as you're hearing change. But I do want to ask you about the attack itself by way of, I think, a very real-world and relevant example of something a little bit different than what happened here. So perhaps you could talk a little bit about what happened in the Hearsay Culture site within, you know, the realm of not wanting it to be repeated, but also how that might be relevant to the kinds of services that you'd offer through Securing Change.
Sure. So I would categorize what I did for you as incident response, which means the attacks already happened. You no longer have control of your website. And I come in, I figure out what the attacker is doing, I find a way to expel the attacker, and then to shore up your defenses to make sure the attacker cannot get back in. And so when you had contacted me, I believe your website was advertising Propecia, maybe?
Yeah, Propecia, Cialis, Viagra. Yeah. Just again, and I don't normally talk about this kind of inside baseball stuff on the show. In other words, I don't do the show about the show. This isn't the Howard Stern show or something like that. But I am going to mention it here. So, I had occasionally, just to set this up, Oliver, I had occasionally noticed when I did Google searches of Hearsay Culture that there would be links to Cialis or Viagra, and frankly, there were one or two, and I ignored them. But then one day I got an email from an information technology person at a major state university that basically said, hi, Dave, fan of the show, and Hearsay Culture is sending spam involving Viagra and Cialis to our servers. So fortunately, this IT person knew what Hearsay Culture was, i.e. that it wasn't in the business of selling Viagra and Cialis, but that brought home to me how serious the issue was. I'll defer to your judgment on this, Oliver, but I don't have a problem with you discussing, at least, you know, in general terms, what the attackers did as an example of the kinds of cyber threats that you deal with, and really to contextualize this discussion, because like I said, this is certainly when I was convinced that there was a need for the organization. So do you want to say anything about what the attackers did? Because my recollection is that you had said that it was a somewhat clever or even unique type of attack.
Yeah, it really was. So what the attacker was after was your Google rank. You have a website that, you know, ranks very highly. It is not known for being a peddler of, you know, illicit pharmaceuticals. Or I guess it's not illicit, but just, you know, things that you need a prescription for.
Well, I peddle nothing, so other than content.
And so what they had done was they exploited a WordPress plugin. And I have very mixed feelings about WordPress. I'm all for making it easier for the masses to communicate with the world, but it's more or less a security nightmare. They're doing a better job about getting updates to people, and get making it easier for people to update WordPress as new exploits are figured out. But what the attacker had done was figured out a way to overwrite some of your WordPress files without your permission, or without even knowing your FTP password. And so they overwrote one of the core files that sort of bootstraps the entire WordPress system. And instead of infecting all of your actual content with ads for, you know, Cialis and Viagra and all that stuff, it would render the ads on the fly. So if you, you know, were unskilled and you just looked at your content, like, in the database, you'd say, like, there's nothing here. I don't understand. But what, you know, what it was, if you looked at one particular file, you would see this very heavily obfuscated JavaScript, which means that it's, you know, JavaScript is just a scripting language. But instead of just sort of straight up programming, like, 10, print hello, 20, go to 10, they took it all and sort of ran it through a cipher so that if you just looked at it, you would just see a big blob of text. And you I literally had to go through and decrypt it a few times, or decipher it a few times before I even understood what it was doing. They also overwrote a file that basically controls how the website reacts to different requests. So what it did was say, if you are requesting from Google.com, then show them this one particular page. And if they're anybody else, then show them something else. And so what they were able to do was convince Google that your website was in fact a wholesaler of all these pharmaceuticals. And if anybody was searching for Cialis, because your Google rank is so high, your website would be one of the top hits. And then if someone clicked on it, they would see a web page just full of, you know, click here for whatever, and they clicked on it, and they would go to the actual site selling, you know, the drug that they were looking for. I think this is, you know, this is, of all the types of attacks, the ones that are motivated by money are the easiest ones to deal with. You just have to make it cost more to the attacker than it's worth. Unfortunately, your website has such a high ranking, they just keep coming back. I think they're still trying to attack it. We've just erected a defense. Well, no pun intended there.
Yeah.
We put up a defense that that they haven't been able to bypass at this point. If you were an NGO, right? You were, you know, someone who was advocating for political rights, same-sex marriage rights, you would see a different class of attacker, someone who's not motivated by money, someone who's motivated by politics, and they might not stop, right? They might escalate their attack, because it's not about the money for them, right? It's a personal thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we got lucky, right? Like, you'd only have to deal with someone who's motivated by money, and as long as we stay a step ahead of them, there's plenty of other easy targets out there that are unpatched, and they're going to go after them. Unfortunately, I've noticed that the few times that, like, my system went down for maintenance or whatever, the attacker was right back in there, so I had to sort of cleanse the system again. So now I have sort of redundant systems to make sure that type of situation is covered.
Well, this is why. So I'll and again, you know, I said the caveat at the beginning of the show. I should say it again in the middle that I am on the board of Securing Change. But I, you know, I wouldn't be involved in any organization unless I felt strongly about its mission. And here I think, you know, you plan to and are beginning to do incredible work, and my involvement in large measure comes from my own personal experience with you, and again, to be clear, for listeners, volunteering without literally any compensation from me to do this work. Of course, Hearsay Culture is truly a non-profit, because not only are there no profits, there's no revenue. So there's literally no money. But be that as it may, this is the transition. So let's talk about that. So Securing Change is a new organization. Before we get into what you would do, perhaps you could just tell us the current status and structure of Securing Change.
Sure. As you said earlier, we are in our infancy, and if you look at my resume, you will notice very quickly that I've worked for a nonprofit, but I didn't run it, and everything else has been for profit. So as the founder and the person running the show, I don't really, I'm executive director or president or whatever, but I'm still learning a lot about how to run an organization like this. The trickiest question so far is how do we become self-sustaining? And that we're still figuring out. I would honestly love to be able to just offer pro bono services for the rest of the life of this organization. It's going to be very hard because I continue to have to do contract work on the side because, unfortunately, I can't pay my rent or buy groceries with Goodwill. And so, you know, at some point, we're working on right now is a revenue model that is pay what you can. And so you can pay us $0. That's fine. We're, like I said, I'm more than happy to do pro bono work. But you know, it's been pointed out to me and there are other people, on our team. We have, a vice president and a treasurer and there's five others that joined David, on our board of directors. And they're helping me figure out a fair revenue model. I tried to do a sliding scale model, but I'm apprehensive of discouraging anyone from seeking out our services simply because they have an operating budget over a certain amount. And so I feel like the pay what you want model or what you can model is the best way forward right now. And so what I'm doing is saying it can be free if you want or if you need. We're going to put a cap of $75 an hour, and that's based on the IRS rules that say nonprofits can't charge market rates. So I'm continually looking to see what the market charges for these types of services and then offering the cap as a limit below what that is, what those market rates are.
So let me interrupt you, Oliver, and just ask you, because before we even get to the revenue model, we should define what the it is. So do you say these services or it, right? The website, securingchange.org, references three types of services: vulnerability scanning, web content scanning, and incident response. You mentioned in with reference to what you did for hearsayculture.com, the incidents response work, which would be, you know, part of it, and again, and coming up with a sophisticated way to prevent future attacks. But perhaps those first two elements you should describe. What is vulnerability scanning and web content scanning as would be offered to clients of Securing Change?
Right. So there are programs out there that are called vulnerability scanners, and they are designed to basically probe another computer on the internet. So it could be your web server, it could be your internal office systems, and what they do is they probe these machines and look for signs that the computer could be exploited. So that might be that your computer hasn't installed the latest patches, or your WordPress doesn't have the latest version, or like the plugins are outdated. And so these programs are a way to automatically assess how far behind, your systems are and what they might be vulnerable to. And so, we have volunteers, and they're able to scan, right now we're very heavily focused on web servers because they're, you know, they face the public at all times, like your internal computers. There's only so many people that can get to those usually, unless you count spear phishing. But the outside web server, it's in epidemiological terms, everyone is your neighbor, right? So like when you think about how the flu spreads, you can only get the flu from someone like that you've seen that day, right? Now, granted, they might have been on a flight from Beijing and like they got to you, but really like someone in Beijing can't cough and give you the flu. But on the internet, that's how it works. Anyone, anywhere in the world that can touch your server can take over your server. Mm-hmm. And so we spend the most time and effort assessing those machines because we feel like they're at the greatest risk. And so the penetration test is a test to see, how vulnerable is your system from an overall perspective. Now, the web content scanning is very similar, except we're looking for like the thing that happened to Hearsay's web server, right, or website, right? So if you think about it, the penetration test is a test, an assessment of the server itself. whereas the web content scanning is an assessment of the application. So we're going to look at all of the content on your website. We're going to look for signs that you've already been infected, so iframes that point to like Russia, even though you've done nothing with Russia anywhere else on your website, JavaScript that is obfuscated and is just, for lack of a better term, sketchy. But we also look for weaknesses, right? There's something called a cross-site scripting, which is a form of attack where, like, if your website allows people to leave a comment, you can leave a comment sometimes in a way where looking at the comment or clicking on the comment will infect you. So we look for entry points like that, and we figure out if it's vulnerable, and then alert you to that, and then help you figure out a way to fix it, to basically sanitize the input or to make it safe. Or maybe our advice will be, look, do you really need the comments? They're not that important. You should just get rid of them. Our big challenge is, we're not normally dealing with very well-funded organizations. So, the thing that I've had the most practice at is saying, well, there are a bunch of different solutions on the market. You'll have to spend this much, and that's your solution. Most of these organizations that we're dealing with do not have, they're below that security poverty line. So we have to become very clever in what we offer in terms of a solution. So if your website is vulnerable and you don't have any real way to secure it, the answer might be, well, let's figure out a way to automate your backup so that when you are attacked, you can revert back to a clean copy. Because surprisingly, most people don't have automated backups. It's one of the things that bugs me. It's like dentists and flossing. I'm sure it bothers them to no end, the people that don't floss. Automated backups are like one of the easiest ways to make an attack reversible. So what? Yeah, fine, they got in. Who cares? Nuke the website, burn it to the ground, for lack of a better term. Change everyone's passwords and just restore your website from a very recent copy that you know hasn't been infected. So what I feel like the value that we're trying to bring to the nonprofit world are realistic solutions for people that don't have any budget whatsoever.
We're chatting with Oliver Day of Securing Change on KZSEFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So, Oliver, you mentioned some of the people involved. So, once a given entity contacts you, and at the end of the show we'll talk about how they can contact you, but, once they contact you, what happens? I mean, what would be the typical, plan of attack, as it were, to deal with that? And you mentioned also, some of the people. Perhaps you want to talk about who is on the ground there in Cambridge, who would be doing this work?
Well, interestingly, the people on the ground here in Cambridge are our support staff. So, like, we have a treasurer and someone who's in charge of our marketing and our brand. Our volunteers are kind of everywhere. In the beginning, were coming from my personal network, from the industry. But we have people in New York, San Francisco, Cambridge, Austin, Texas. So we're setting up, and we'll talk about it later, but a lot of different ways for people to get in touch with us. And I've just set up a ticketing system so that we can sort of handle a larger influx. And what happens is if someone contacts us and asks us for help, it goes into the ticketing queue. And right now I'm wearing a lot of hats. At some point this will probably be delegated, but right now it's mostly me. The ticket goes into the queue. The ticket gets examined. So, what kind of problem are they having? Is it their website? Do they need security architecture advice? Like, recently one of our clients said, we want to add video to our website. How do we do that in a way that will not open us up to further attack? And so based on what they need, I look through the list of all of our volunteers, and I assign someone. Sometimes it's me, sometimes it's someone else. And with volunteers, it's a little trickier because, they're donating their time to me for nothing. So I've been setting up sort of a redundant volunteer system where I assign two volunteers at a time. So that way, if one starts to lack the time, the other one can just pick it up and run with it. And then we engage with the client. We figure out, what we can do for them, in terms of assessment. you know, basically that means the volunteers are going to use that program to assess, you know, how vulnerable the application or the server is. They write up a report. Someone analyzes the report to look for things called false positives. But then we have to sort of, like I said, look at the advice and critically assess where is this organization in terms of funding, in terms of IT power. Like, do they have a dedicated technical person? Because if we tell them, well, we see that you're being attacked by this one IP address, can you just block that IP address? They might say, no, we don't know how to do that. So we need we make sure that the advice is applicable to them, that they can work with it. And once the advice has been dispensed, we set a follow-up. So, you know, like for one customer, we went into their internal systems, their office computers. We checked for rootkits. And then we installed something that would let them know. We installed Komodo for those who want to look at that program, to see, you know, like if some program is trying to make an outbound connection, it will tell you about it. But we set a follow up because what we find is that sometimes, and I understand why, but people get annoyed with these programs because they're like, hey, there's a thing trying to make contact with a server, and it's just Microsoft Office trying to get an update, and you have to continually say, like, yeah, that's fine, just shut up and just let me do my work. And what we do is we come back to make sure they haven't disabled all the stuff that we put in place. And I feel like this is something a lot of for-profits don't really do because there's no profitable way to do this kind of follow-on work. It's only when you actually care about people and what they're doing that you're going to put this much effort into making sure that the solution works for them. And, you know, like sometimes we're like, okay, fine, that's a little too much for you. Why don't we tone down some of the security recommendations and just, you know, like maybe up the monitoring so that we can see better when you're being attacked or when things are happening. But that's the general process for you know, people coming in, they get assigned. I'm right now the sort of managing director as well. So I oversee any of the operations that are going on. In terms of like customer interaction, and I have a very heavy hand in terms of making sure that everybody's happy, from the consultant or the volunteer, I should say, to the client themselves. And again, it is a learning process, you know. And with volunteer work, sometimes the client goes silent for a while because they're not paying any money, and there's nothing for them to lose. They just sort of like, oh, was there a meeting? I'm sorry, I forgot about that. And sometimes the volunteers get busy. So, you know, we're continually refining the system to make sure that everybody's happy, but also that things are getting done and that we're being effective in the thing that we're actually trying to do.
So Oliver Day of Securing Change on KCCFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So we have about 4 minutes left, Oliver, and you said there are several ways to contact you. And so assuming that at this point, which I think you do have the resources to handle clients as they come in the door, because this is a new organization, but it is not an organization merely on paper. You are, in fact, doing work, which is wonderful, and I'm thrilled and honored to be involved in this process. But for those people that might want to reach out to you to learn more about Securing Change, to retain you and your volunteers, how can they reach you, and what kind of information do you need?
So we've set up a ticketing system that's email-based. So if you write an email to help@rt.securingchange.org, I should probably work on that email address, but for now that's the one, it will generate a ticket automatically in our system, and I'm sure we're going to get spam now. But
well, that's par for the course. So it's give me that email address again one more time.
Help@rt as in Romeo Tango rt.securingchange.org, and that will send just an email into our system. I've also set up a Google form. That will just dump, you know, whatever you write into it into a spreadsheet. And it's got, you know, a bunch of questions on there. I don't actually recall what the URL is offhand. Is there any way we can maybe put that in the show notes?
I will do that.
Or what? Okay, so one thing I want to stress is email and forms, even on Google, are inherently insecure. So consider these entry points as a way to get our attention, to let us know that you're having problems, and then we will figure out a secure way for you to tell us more sensitive things. So by all means, give us information about like what attack you're going through, but don't send us passwords. Refrain from sending out anything that you wouldn't that you find critical and sensitive. Save that for the future conversations that we'll have. We'll find a way to communicate securely after that initial email. But these are just ways to get into the system so that a ticket is generated and a volunteer will be assigned, and then you guys can figure out maybe it's over the phone. Maybe we teach you very quickly how to use GPG, which is an encryption software, so that you can send us things without anybody that's able to listen in being able to see those things. But those are the two main methods. We're open to having as many ways to get our attention as possible. If people want an IRC channel, I don't think anyone does, but if people want an IRC channel, we have a Tumblr where I blog. We have a Twitter account at Securing Change. Ping us at any of these, in any of these ways, and we will respond. And again, we will find a way to securely get information from you, so that we can talk further about how we can help.
So again, that's help at RT. RomeoTango.securingchange.org. Oliver Day of securingchange.com, thank you for joining today on the show, discussing your organization. I look forward to having you on again in the future and to not only following but being involved in the launch and the success of this terrific organization. I, again, just I'm a fan and thrilled to be involved in this. The critical need for, particularly for nonprofits and non-governmental organizations, to have some protection, particularly when you're dealing with issues like speech and liberty, to me are essential, and so I'm just happy to help out any way I can. Oliver, thank you for joining us today on the show.
Thank you so much, Dave.
A number of guests are coming up on the remaining shows for this quarter. Next week, Dr. Virginia Crisp, a lecturer at Middlesex University on Kim.com and copyright infringement. Ellen Broad, the executive officer of the Australian Digital Alliance, on May 29th. And rounding out this quarter on June 5th, Susan Chalmers, the policy leader of Internet New Zealand. I have a number of guests that I am now scheduling for the summer quarter on KZSU's calendar, which will begin in July. Among those guests are Professor Vance Ricks of Guilford College, Ron Epstein, the CEO of Epicenter IP Group on patent non-practicing entities, also known as patent trolls, Professor Phil Napoli of Fordham University on algorithms in media, Professor Devin Desai of Thomas Jefferson Law School on 3D printing, Professor James Moliterno of Washington Lee School of Law and Technology and Legal Education, Lucevijs van der Laan, former EU MP on technology and promoting democracy, and Professor Mike Rich, my colleague at Elon Law, on criminal acts and technologies designed to limit them. This quarter, you can listen to KZSU Live Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific Time. That time may change each quarter, but at least through the beginning of June, you can get the show live that way, or you can get the show via podcast, either by going to the iTunes page for the Stanford Center for Internet Society, or by going to the webpage for Stanford's Center for Internet Society at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all 182 previous shows as well as the upcoming schedule. I'm always interested in potential guests that you might suggest to me. You can email me with any comments, suggestions, feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. As I've mentioned a few times on previous shows, this past semester was quite busy. Of course, I've had quite busy semesters repeatedly over the last several years, but this summer should be a bit calmer. I do intend to put more time into scheduling Hearsay Culture interviews, and so I anticipate fewer repeat shows. But I appreciate your patience as I put the show together. And again, I welcome your feedback and comments and criticism at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for joining me today on KZSU and on Hearsay Culture. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.